Welcome to Executing the Vision podcast. I'm your host, Brad Hunter, president of Emerge Labs. On the podcast, we'll get to know the person behind the vision, their successes, their challenges, and their plans for the future. If you're interested in becoming a guest or know someone who might be a good fit, stick around to the end and we'll discuss how to apply. Now, enjoy the show. All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Executing the Vision. Today, I've got Terry Zimniak. Did I get that exactly right or probably not?
Pretty darn close, Brad. Close enough.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. With Tech-O. And yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you. So I also am in the software space. 10 years ago or so, we built a platform. I knew nothing of software, still know very little. But we built a SaaS platform 13 years ago and fell into that space. And ever since then, I do that as well as business consulting. And so when I came across and saw your profile and everything, I was very excited to just talk to you to learn. Because admittedly, the whole cybersecurity side of things is something that I personally should probably be more knowledgeable on. My team's great. They take care of it. They do a wonderful job. We've never had anything close to an issue. I want to understand more personally about this. Looking forward to the whole conversation and learning more about this space. But before we get into that, let's just learn about you and just tell me your story. Where did you grow up? What was life like there? What kind of led you here from growing up to then we'll make our way to college and how it steered you in this direction?
Gotcha. I think the biggest influencer for me growing up was the fact my dad was military. So every couple of years, we moved around Rhode Island, Florida, Hawaii, Chicago, all over the place. So we, as a kid, transitioning through a lot of schools, a lot of friends, a lot of cultures and little communities. So learned how to pivot pretty quickly growing up. And I think that's probably the biggest influencer. As a kid or even a young adult, the longest time I stayed in one spot was in college, the 4 years of college. So that's how much bouncing around. And ended up seeing one young woman, her name was Denise, ran into her senior year in Chicago in the same high school. And we were together in first grade in Hawaii.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. And now, so from that, from like the childhood experiences that was there a, oh my gosh, like this spot, Hawaii was so magical. I can't believe it. Or did it have more of a feeling of we're going to be here, but it's almost like an extended vacation. I'm going to be here for a year or two. Then I know I'm going to go somewhere else. Or what was that actually like?
That was just life for me. So it was hard to compare it to anything else, but I was the baby of the family, which some people say is more obvious than in my personality and others might say, but youngest kid, it was life. I followed my brother and sister around and we were pretty separate age-wise. So I'm the youngest by 5 years from my sister in the middle. So we weren't particularly close as kids. They were doing their thing. And I'm sure I was tagging along when mom would make them bring me along, but it was just life. It's hard to say it was good or bad. It is what it is. Kids adjust. I don't know that I particularly appreciated one versus another. Hawaii was great looking back at it. My parents tell stories. This was mid-70s, Waikiki Beach. Santa Claus would come in on an outrigger canoe. We'd be at the beach. Santa Claus is riding the surf coming in. When I was first grade or second grade, they really didn't mean anything. It was cool, but that was about it. I remember playing outside Christmas Day with my toys as a kid. Right after Hawaii, they went directly to Chicago. And that was a pivot that we weren't ready for because it was
Christmas. Weather at Christmas was a little different then.
That was just it. So we got there. Maybe we had a nice day early May in Chicago. So maybe mid-70s. Oh, man, let's go to Lake Michigan. It's going to be great. So we all went booking into Lake Michigan. And, man, there must have been chunks of ice floating in the water. It was so dang cold. And we got, like, up to our knees in the water screaming. And mom had to come pull us out of the water because it was just like an ice bath. So I guess you learned some lessons traveling around as well.
Nice. Okay. So then from there, it was high school in Chicago. And then I see you made your way to Michigan State.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, three different high schools, Chicago, Florida, and Virginia. Went to three different high schools.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Went on to Michigan State. That's probably where I had the biggest influence in growing up. So I actually had a good clique of friends. And 30 some years later, we still keep in touch. But that's where I started to get my hands on computers, started banging around computers a little bit. Back then, way back then, Brad, there was two types of computer classes. There's hardware and software, and that's all they had. And about 15 years ago, I got my master's, and there was three programs in cybersecurity at the master's level. That's how much computers have expanded and their influence, the business part of computers, the technology part, the security part, the way people see computers and deal with computers has changed. And that you can see that in the education programs that are available in that space.
And what drew you to it? Was it like you were a video game guy? And so that, or what is it that, or was it just the idea of, hey, this seems like a smart avenue to go. There seems like there could be a great future. What really, because it looks your whole career, you've been knee deep in this, right?
Yeah, I don't even know exactly what got me into computers. So my mom, she ended up buying a computer for the household in maybe 87 or so, 86 maybe. And it was this 50-pound brick we had all upstairs and big stacks of manuals. I didn't know how to use it. So as a middle of my high school career, we had a computer and I didn't even know how to turn it on. Senior in high school, dabbled a little bit. We had a computer class. So I got to do the old snake program where you'd run a snake around.
Right.
The screen,
yeah.
Like that. I don't know. I probably like a lot of my life just stumbled into it and it worked well for me. And I latched onto it. What I appreciate about computers and I appreciate through my career is when I was writing code, there was definitive answers. So it wasn't a soft skill. You had an objective. You can get it done when you're done. So I like the computer part about that. But career-wise, you talk about cybersecurity, Brad, what led me to security and probably what made me pretty good at it is I'm good at a lot of things. I'm not great at anything. I've spent a couple of years doing database work and network work and server work and programming, all this stuff. So I've got very broad experience in a lot of technologies. Again, certainly not an expert in any of them, but that broad is what helped me in the security space. So I could talk to the technologies. And then later my career has pivoted to the business. Again, I had competent skills in a whole lot of areas. So that's what worked for me.
Okay. So we're at Michigan State. We finished there. And then did you go right to DePaul or what was the...
Yeah, DePaul for graduate school. That was, about 15 years after my undergrad. So got out of college and my first job at a college, I still remember after college, I moved back home and dad's there. He's like, so how's the job hunt coming? Yeah, working on it. So after a week, this is how old I am, is he was bringing the want ads to me with jobs circled for me. So I'd have to type out my application, mail it in, and ended up getting a job just physically building computers in a warehouse. And we were putting them in pizza places around Chicago. So I got to build the computers and buy them. And within a couple of months, my boss, who was there occasionally, he just stopped showing up. He was there maybe once a week. But after a few months, I was in charge of the whole small operation. I would source the equipment. I would build the computers. I would install the software. I would set up the installation, install the restaurant, train everyone. So again, being good at a lot of things, not great, good at a lot of things, set me up well in that first gig out of college. And then from there, started getting into a little more of the corporate world, bigger and bigger companies.
Okay. And then, yeah, so you're going, bouncing bigger companies, and then you decide to go back to DePaul to get your master's. And why that move? Why not just keep doing what you're doing?
Through my career, I realized there's a need to continue to improve. So whatever improve may mean for me or for anyone, sitting static's no fun. You always want to look at new stuff. So early in their career was the HIPAA space, which is the cybersecurity healthcare sort of space. That was an area I really focused on and dug deep on that. And that was my area of focus for all P, which is the preeminent cybersecurity certification that's out there. I self-studied through that. So just every couple of years, I just latch onto something and dig really deep into it and thought I was ready for graduate school. And I enjoyed graduate school. I got much more value out of graduate school than undergrad because undergrad to me didn't feel particularly applicable. Hey, we're going to talk about how to do different sorting methodology in computers. Like, how do you sort stuff? Who really cares? Or you're taking your communication class or your psychology, just very abstract, can't really apply it undergraduate level. When I got to graduate school, I'd already had 5-10 years of work experience. So when we're talking about stuff, I'm like, damn, I know exactly what they're talking about. I know how to apply that to my company. I know how to do this. I know how to do that. I ended up using my work situation for my master's thesis. So again, it was really applicable and it meant a lot to me. I was able to dig deep. So I really got a lot of value out of graduate school.
Okay, nice. But yeah, I agree with the undergrad thing. I felt like it was a great general life experience, but I went to business school and then came right out of there and was been involved in owning and running business ever since. And when I look back, it's just, man, the things they taught us compared to what you really need to know, there's a pretty big gap there. Okay,
Yeah,
so
that's interesting because they're also talking about what today, 2024, what's the current value of a college degree? That's the big debate that's out there. I know some big companies like Google, they're taking the degree requirement out of their job descriptions in certain cases. It's interesting to see what college is going to look like 10 years from now that I've just said two of my three kids are through school and I'm paid off two or three of them are coming. Once the last one's done, probably the whole paradigm is going to blow up and you don't need college anymore. So we'll see.
I think just the general cost of it, just the pure math of it all is just, it's so insanely expensive. And there's, shoot, I probably, of the very successful people I know in life, the multimillionaire people, at best it's 50-50 that went to college. A good chunk of them did not. And it's not like it's a requirement to be successful in life, and to come out with that sort of $250,000 burden is just like, how do you ever win?
That's true, but what I'm seeing is these kids are stuck behind the requirements at the companies. At corporate America, I hire a lot of people, and you always have to start with a job description, and they use those requirements and background to set the scale for the salary and everything. So in the job description, if you don't have a bachelor's, most likely you're not even going to get a conversation. So it's really just the marker to get in the door, and then you present yourself as a viable option.
Certainly be interesting to see the direction, because I do think there has to be a shift in that thing.
Yeah, and I think technology is the obvious way to do it. So if you can show competency in Google or Python or whatever the technology du jour is, that's an easy way to quantify or measure competency. In the old days, the bachelor's degree is just general life competency. You can make it through school, you can show up on time, you can turn in your assignments. That's probably what it equated to 50 years ago.
All right. Okay, so now you finish up DePaul. Now let's get into cybersecurity. So when do you really dive into that side of your career?
I've been in cybersecurity pretty much since I got out of school. Maybe the first 5 years I mentioned I was building computers and installing in restaurants. There really wasn't much cybersecurity there. But pretty much since then, everything I was doing was aware of cybersecurity. So I was working at a cybersecurity consulting company. I was working at one of their clients hired me to build their security and their HIPAA compliance, HIPAA being the medical regulations, building security for the medical company. Then I went off with Sears Corporate. Worked with them in cybersecurity, big company. And then from there, I went to some healthcare organizations. My career, by the way, I describe it's currently three phases. Phase one was super technical, where I was bits and bytes guys and architecting stuff and doing penetration testing, all the cool cybersecurity stuff. The phase two was as a cyber executive. So I've got about a decade of experience as a VP of cybersecurity, chief information security officer at big healthcare organizations. And then thirdly, I'm doing fractional executive, which kind of ties the two together. So helping small and mid-sized businesses, somewhat with the technology, but more with the business part of cybersecurity. So that generally that's been the arc of my career, technology executive, now tying the two together.
Okay. And then here's my question about cybersecurity. Who does not need it? Because I think that, because my perspective on this, especially the past couple of years, is I almost view it like insurance, that it's just something that, man, ever you have insurance on your house, you have insurance on your car, you just have insurance. And you know that, hey, the hope is I never use it. That's what you're, but everybody does it. And to me, like, cybersecurity is a little bit along that same line. I don't, you tell me, to me, I feel like a lot of people haven't crossed that mental transition yet. Like, they don't realize they need it until they get themselves in a bind. And so that's my first question is, first of all, who does not really need to worry about it? Is there anybody out there that truly, whatever, you don't need to worry about cybersecurity?
If you're sitting in a shack in the middle of Montana with no electronics, you don't need it. But everything else is just all built in. Now, what you don't need, and this was a common point I make to when I'm talking about it, you need to understand how secure you have to be. So if you're a business, I think there's two distinct conversations, Brad, business and then individual perspective. With the business, generally, you got to be secure enough to sell. And that means, what do your prospects require? What do your clients require? What does regulations require? What does your cyber insurance require? So there's all sorts of external requirements now for businesses that kind of explain what's that right line of security. On the personal side, it's a little bit different. You can't control too much. You can control the basics. And all you really do need to do as an individual is understand best practice. So we talked about before you and I got on the video here, X, is your Twitter properly secured? Is it secure enough? Your home network, is it secure? Your laptop. So there's little bits and pieces on the personnel side. But yeah, anyone that has electronics and deals those devices should be aware of cybersecurity. But you're exactly right. It's risk and it's an insurance policy. You got to be good enough. You got to figure out where you need to be and then go be good enough.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. On a personal front, VPNs. I mean, are you a fan of having a VPN for personal reasons?
Yeah, there's different reasons why a VPN would be good or bad, but absolutely, there's no harm in doing it. Now, the downside is, and I always think back to my mom who passed a few years ago, but she'd always call me, hey, Terry, I got a problem with my computer, and she's in Arizona. Like, well, I don't know what to tell you, mom, and she's using a Mac on top of that. So she gets advice from someone, she puts something on her computer and breaks it, then she calls me to help her. I'm like, thanks for paying for college for me, but I can't help you fix a Mac. I don't know what to do with you. So yeah, any of those kind of foundational consumer grade protections are all great, but you got to make sure it works and it's not going to break your stuff. Pay for it. Don't get the freebie versions out there. Oftentimes there's good stuff included. The Windows nowadays is pretty secure. Go run all the default stuff like the automatic updates, use the Window Defender, Chrome, for example. Your browser is a big source of the bad stuff on the internet. Make sure your browser is properly protected. I know in Chrome just recently helping a client through this, we just realized that Chrome has settings. If you go in the security settings, it says, do you want Chrome really secure, standard secure, or not secure at all? Like, that seems like a silly question. Go make it super secure. It may break things. You have to be thoughtful. But point being, make sure your tools like your browsers, your computers have the foundational best practice stuff that the vendor would recommend.
And what's your take on Mac versus PC for a security perspective?
Again, it depends. If you're my mom living in Arizona, I don't want you using a Mac because I can't help you support it. So again, super secure yeah. Technology that isn't usable, it's no good to anybody. But that being said, yeah, Mac is foundationally a little more secure just the way they work. Traditional viruses don't really impact them the way that the Macs do, the isolation of stuff inside the operating system. But I'll tell you, the biggest problem by far, Brad, is not really computers per se. It's not your Mac or your iPhone or your Windows device. It's all the stuff on the internet. So when you think you're signing on to bradsbank.com, are you really going to Brad's Bank? Maybe it's a fake site. All the emails that you get coming down, is your email properly filtered? I was just reading an article today. It said 72% of ransomware comes through email.
Yeah.
Well, you better start filtering that stuff pretty aggressively. Browsing, so it's a combination. Point being, a static box by itself is one thing. It's really all the internet stuff you have to worry about. If I were to choose, I made these comments before. If you have $1 to spend, where would you spend it on the internet part of what you do. Your browser, your filtering, your VPNs, those sorts of things.
Okay, and yeah, so now let's talk about the business side of things. So personal experience I had last year before, consulting with a mortgage bank, nationwide mortgage bank, and I'm helping them on some operational software stuff. And then one day, the typical thing, just somebody opened the email. And oh my gosh, everything they had to do to deal with that nightmare was just crazy. There were two, three people in the office full time for weeks going over everything that went on. And so my question to that is what is the almost the ratio, right? Because if they would have spent a little money to put some more security in up front, is there some sort of like a 10 to 1 for every dollar you are willing to spend up front, you're going to save 10 on the back end? Or is there any sort of a ratio like that?
Not that I'm aware of, because most cybersecurity incidents have multiple things that have to fail to make them work correctly. So this email that came in, the scenario you're talking about, there's probably some sort of email filtering in Microsoft that didn't catch it. There was antivirus on the computer that didn't catch it. Maybe antivirus on the server that didn't catch it. The user clicked on it. The user had excessive access rights. That's always a big problem. So if in this case, if Brad gets a virus, Brad's in trouble. If Brad, the administrator, gets a virus, the whole company's in trouble. Point being, multiple things can fail. So when you talk about what's the right spend, it's not, you got to think broadly and consider that, again, back to make your security like Terry. Go be pretty good at a lot of things. Don't be great at any one thing. Go be good at a lot of things. So be good at your email filtering. Be good at your antivirus. Be good at your user access right management. Be good at your incident response. Be good at your disaster recovery. Go be good at everything. Don't try to be great at anyone.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. Okay. And now talk to me about how you engage with a customer. Somebody reaches out to you. Just walk me through that whole piece of it. How initially explain things, how to figure out what their needs might be and how you can work with them.
Typically, when I engage with a business, they've got one of a couple sorts of scenarios. One is something bad just happened to us, or recently happened to us. Number two is a friend of mine had a problem, or I read about something in an article. So I got a nebulous, we want to get better. And the third scenario, and this is actually happening more and more often, is I can't sell my product because my prospects aren't convinced I'm secure. So those really are the three scenarios I've seen over the past 3 or 4 years. All of them start with a basic assessment. So I position myself as an executive. I'm going to help you understand where you need to go, which is not a trivial first step. Understand where we need to go, come up with a plan to get there, and then find the right people to get the work done. So typically most organizations have some sort of IT in-house or perhaps outsourced IT services. Make sure the IT guys and gals are doing the right things to support your roadmap to get you to the right level of security. There's definitely not a one size fits all, but you have to understand, why do they need security? Interesting, that is generally one question that I will ask my clients. I remember a woman I was dealing with a couple of years ago. She's the CEO of a data analytics company. I said, hey, great, happy to work with you, but let me ask you the question, why do you want to be secure? She says, Terry, we're going to be secure because it's the right thing to do. Oh, that's okay. Good to hear that. Then right behind that, she says, number two, it's going to be a differentiator for us. We're going to sell our analytics service as secure. It's going to be a driver for us. That's why we're going to do this. You need to figure out what the intent is. You could always spend more money on security, but you may not always get value out of spending more. So figure out what you're aiming for and why, and then how do you get there?
And then, okay, so when engaging with customers, what you're doing, you're coming in as a fractional executive, right? To walk them through, and then is it you're dedicating a certain amount of hours a month to that client, and then it's an ongoing, I assume up front, there's a lot more work to do, and then it's more of a maintenance type situation.
Yeah, exactly. It really parallels if I was a full-time. So my experience as CISO at big companies, you'd have some sort of annual planning, you know, hey, what's the cybersecurity plan for this year and why? How does it align with business goals? How does it support the objective? We know we plan on buying more businesses next year. Let's start getting ready for it. We know IT is going to go to the cloud next year. Let's start prepping. So you've got your roadmap that aligns with the rest of the business. That's just early calendar year or cycle year planning, which you're roadmap. And then as an executive, you oversee the execution of it. Hey, IT, we need to deploy multi-factor authentication. Hey, servers guys, we're going to do a disaster recovery tabletop this year. So yeah, it's very analogous to having a full-time executive. It's just less of me because typically I wouldn't do the management sorts of stuff, managing staff and whatnot. But I do tell you, this is an advantage of a lot of getting a good fractional, is a good fractional executive can interface throughout the company. So bring me on, I or another executive could interface with your prospects and your clients. They can interface with your insurance broker. They could interface with local internal stakeholders and external stakeholders. So again, you really get with a good seasoned executive, you will still get the value of the executive.
And talk to me about timing. So another thing I want to talk about, the idea of exit strategy, or you're going to have some sort of a big merger coming up, or a big new client, where a company is concerned, or maybe they're just, you know, ignorant to the fact of they need to have these types of thing in place. How long, what's a time frame, right? Where, okay, I'm looking to sell my company right now. There's a tech factor to the company in some way, shape, or form. What would be the time frame for, okay, get in touch with you, make sure everything from the security side is all buttoned up so it doesn't somehow blow up the deal?
That's interesting. So I've got a prospect I'm working with now where we're buttoning up the SOW. This company is selling their services into some insurance companies. And the insurance company is saying, hey, we need to make sure you need to have a SOC 2 being an audit function that kind of covers the basics of cybersecurity. So they came to me saying, hey, we need to accomplish this. So it's unusual, but they have a distinct deadline and they have expectations of what they do and how quickly they do it. That's actually not a bad thing, because then that will allow me to talk about resource planning. So if we know we have X amount of work to do in 6 months, we can work on the resources accordingly. But more often than not, they don't have distinct flags in the road saying we must hit X within 12 months. That's just, risk management doesn't typically work that way. But again, what I'll do is I'll do the assessment saying, hey, these are the 12 things that need to be on our radar. Reasonably, we can knock out 4 this year. And then we reconsider next year. Maybe there's 8 left. Maybe something popped up. Maybe something dropped off the list. But it's the kind of business planning that executives do. But once you know what you're trying to accomplish, Q3 is going to be disaster recovery planning. Q4 is going to be user education, whatever it may be. You can have clarity. You have a good conversation on what you're doing once you have agreement on the roadmap.
And what do you find clients that you initially engage with that they're doing something on that security front, right? But probably not as much as they should be doing. And what are the big pitfalls when you initially come in? What are the kind of top things that your average company, if they don't have somebody like you in place, is missing out on?
I'll tell you exactly what that is, Brad. The number one problem I see with my clients is what I refer to as, they just don't know their stuff, meaning they don't know where their data's at. They have some medical, they have some credit card, they have some employee facing, they have business plans. They got data and it's generally in this area, but they don't really know where their data's at and they don't know what the expectations are. So that data governance is a mess. They don't necessarily know their people. They've got employees. They may or may not have association with HR records. They've got contractors. They got offshore this, they got outsource that. They don't know who their people are. They don't have a good track of their contracts, their vendors, their clients. The contracts are not in place, their devices. So the foundational of just inventory and understanding where everything's at, a lot of people struggle with it because it's hard. If you don't have a program in place to track the data and the contracts and everything else, you don't know where things are. And that's just foundational. If you can't identify all your people, you can't turn on multi-factor necessarily. If you can't identify all your devices, you can't make sure it's all encrypted. If you don't know where your data is at, you can't make sure it's all backed up. That foundational part, a lot of people really struggle with.
Yeah, which makes perfect sense. And then I imagine too, if you're in that scenario and God forbid something does go wrong, it's just absolute nightmare of even figuring out where to begin.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the second big common problem I see, Brad, is people have... they don't think holistically and framework-based. So if Terry comes in and Terry says, hey, based on my experience, I think you're secure. You should stop and say, Terry, how do you know? You don't know everything. You don't know the totality of what we have to look at. My guidance to the business owners and leaders out there is use an established framework, meaning there's been organizations and best practice. These are the 50 things you have to focus on. The most common one out there is NIST Cybersecurity Framework, NIST CSF. There's a new version that came out very recently. But the advantage of using a framework like that, it'll talk about business continuity, and it'll talk about encryption, and it'll talk about training, and it'll talk about contracts. It'll give you a broad view of everything, because if you have your help desk guy in charge of security, he or she's probably going to be really good at the help desk space, but the skill set in business impact analysis may not be there. Your help desk guy could drive security, but leverage a framework. The framework makes sure that you're comprehensive in your thoughts. So that's another big gap, is you don't look holistically because you're not using a framework.
Okay, makes sense. And then talk to me about AI. I always feel like anything computer, you got to talk about AI. So how is that impacting your world now and in the future?
AI comes in a couple of flavors. AI, cybersecurity tools, people like to talk about that. Frankly, AI is just baked in these days. New stuff's coming and it's improving. But when you buy anti-malware tool or a log aggregator SIM kind of tool, AI is just built in and it works. And that's great. So for the security geeks, that's built in. It's going to keep growing. That's something to keep an eye on. Also, you have like office user AI. So Copilot's the big one, ChatGPT, Bard, all the stuff Google has. There's a lot of stuff in that space. That's another avenue. And third is I'm working with companies that are developing AI tools and services to be sold to their clients. So I see it in three big buckets. Universally, excuse me, the most common problem is data governance. Again, what's your data? Where is it? And how can it be used? Can I put my business plans in ChatGPT? I don't know. Someone better think through that. You definitely can't put medical stuff up there. You can't put identifiable information in there. Unless you make special protections or around the generative tool you're working with. But almost always universally, it's a data governance problem.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. Just the whole AI usage thing is interesting, right? I feel like companies in general just jumping in, ooh, it's going to make this great, that great. No, there's this easy little cheap plugin we can do. And then, yeah, the thing of, yes, that's available. Yes, you can do it. But what does that mean from a data security perspective? Should you be doing that?
Exactly. Yeah, typically I talk about data security more broadly as data protection. That's the phrase that I use. So that's security and privacy and compliance as applicable, but they're all merging this together, especially in the AI space, security, privacy, and your compliance regulations.
Okay. And so then somebody wants to get in touch with you. What's the best way to get in touch with you, be able to have a chat and understand if there'd be a good fit?
Yeah. No thing. Happy to talk to anyone who wants. Feel free to reach out to me. You can find me at my company site, TechCXO. You can look for Terry Zimniak. Assume Brad will have links down there.
Yeah,
exactly. So happy to talk to you about cybersecurity or fractional executive services, see if it'd be a fit for you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. Anything else on your end that you want to discuss or any questions you had?
No, I'd say the one takeaway, business owners, is again, just consider this a risk. You're never going to be 100% done with security. It's always going to change. It's going to pivot, but take the mindset that it's a risk, just like your competitive risk and your financial risk and the other risks you have to deal with. Be aware of it and manage the risk. Don't try to solve the risk.
Yeah. I think it's great. It's been wonderful to talk to you. I've certainly learned some things here. I think a service like yours is invaluable from personal experiences that I've had where, yeah, you have an outsourced IT thing, but if they're not necessarily data security experts, right? They're like the lowest bar, not the highest bar from what I've seen a lot of times, right? They're focused on the idea of helping you keep things running. But are they really the right people to ensure you have all that security in place? Not from what I've seen.
Yeah, typically those guys talk at the technology level, and that's great and it's value. The technology is the encryption and maybe the backups and antivirus. Those are certainly of value, but it's part of the program. Even with antivirus and everything else, you're likely to get ransomware sometime. You're going to get phishing attacks. You're going to get whatever. Sometimes bad things are going to happen. So what I like to do, the CISO, the security executive, is going to talk about the umbrella of protecting your company. People, process, and technology, business continuity, business resiliency, as well as the technology. So yeah, business risk is what we'll talk about.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for your time today, Terry. And highly recommend everybody reaches out. I certainly will be talking to you in a little more depth after this.
It's been a pleasure, Brad. Thank you.
Labs.us and click on the podcast page. If you like what you heard, please share the episode and subscribe. Ratings and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. You can find us on Instagram at brad.emergelabs, as well as X, Facebook, and LinkedIn, where we strive to provide valuable information on business and life. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show and what you'd like to see in future episodes. Thank you again, and have a great day.